You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Adam Boxer. Adam, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, can you tell me a little bit about your gallery, where it is and what shows up now, and perhaps the general program of your gallery or how you see it?
Okay, well, the gallery is called Ubu Gallery, and its name comes from a 1896 French, let's call it a play. It was originally intended for marionettes. I can't remember if the first performance was with people or marionettes, but it's been performed in both ways since. It was called Ubu Roi, King Ubu, by Alfred Jarry, and it's a landmark in certainly in modernism. It's pre Dada, nihilistic, anti-authoritarian,
pataphysical. I think
pataphysical. It's a real touchstone that every important 20th century artist had to deal with, and probably every 21st century artist as well has dealt with or will be dealing with still. And we sometimes describe things as Ubu-esque in situations that are sort of nonsensical. And so it really is a proto-Dada. And we took this originally as the name for the gallery because we are a gallery of avant-garde art. And we use that term, and art historians generally use that term to mean art typically between the wars, when there was a real shift in how artists produced, exhibited, did everything differently in art. And certainly a key figure there would be Marcel Duchamp. And we do show this artist who in my pantheon of great artists might be the greatest or is the greatest. I mean, he really alters the perception of everything about art and really allows artists a freedom that they never had before.
You're speaking of Marcel Duchamp.
I'm speaking of Marcel Duchamp. Yeah. And he changes everything. I think he is really the figure. You may not produce art that you liked. You may not see it as art even. That's okay. For artists, he really frees everybody. I think he allows anybody to be an artist in a certain sense, and whatever they produce to be art, and then it's up to the viewer to buy in or not. But doesn't really matter if they do or don't. And so we are doing Dada, Surrealism, Futurism, which is a little earlier than the First World War. It's a 1910 is the first futurist artwork, and we'll go all the way up to around 1970, so to kind of minimalism and conceptualism. So we really are a gallery of isms of modern art, and we're always trying to show something that was important in its time but hasn't art or movements or whatever that were substantially recognized in their time, but time hasn't treated well, or in the, well, I don't really like to say the MoMA vision or kind of timeline of modern art, because I think even MoMA is recanting a little bit on that, that they realize they've left out a whole lot. But we've really made an effort to show things and artists, movements, works that that were influential in their time, but time hasn't treated well.
And that's very interesting, because that's also serving as a role to fill in spaces where, as you're saying, the museum often misses. Your role is educational as well as what I'm saying to the general public, as well as academic art establishment, I would think.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the dealers are the real pioneers in art, in finding art, in finding great artists, in promoting what they find or believe in, and that curators, museum curators, you know, I don't want to be disrespectful of them, and I don't think it is disrespectful of them, because I do think they serve another function, but they're not typically the ones who are taking things from a stage of production, whether that production was yesterday or now almost or exactly 100 years ago, and all of a sudden presenting that. I think dealers have played this really important role in promoting contemporary art in its time, and convincing people that it's worth looking at and assemble. And later, when work doesn't exist in a prepackaged group, they're the ones who are going out and finding it and bringing it all together, which ultimately allows somebody, A, to evaluate it, because it's really hard to evaluate when it's in pieces, spread out all over the place, and you don't really see it, but also providing a critical mass for exhibition. So, you know, it's a twofold thing. You get to see it assembled, and then you get to borrow it. And so I think dealers really have played the, you know, they do the hard part. They put their money up in advance. They buy things. And then, you know, we typically have at least 100 pieces out at any given time on loan to museums and sometimes other galleries. But we always have work out. And a big part of our staffing requirement and needs is really to service loans. It's not even a commercial. Go ahead.
Is that managing the estates of other artists? Is that what that is?
No.
Is that
no, not at all. But we don't represent any estates. We work closely with a couple of estates, but we don't represent estates. And typically, they don't even give us work on consignment. We actually have to buy it. But there's a couple of estates who, I mean, there's one artistic estate, and, you know, if you push me, maybe I'd say their name, but they typically sell to one major museum or to us. It's very rare, if at all, that they go outside of those two venues, you know, the museum and us. Because if they're happy to place the work in a major museum and get paid for it, or they're happy to sell it to us because they know what we do with it and how we treat it, and they know that we're always willing to pay. I mean, I will say also that they've asked us to buy things at prices well in excess of any current market price. And we've done it and had to push the market, but we're always willing to sit there and do that. So let's
talk about exactly what is the market, because you're talking about different dealers, different types of dealers, as I understand it, that are promoting artists in different ways. And if they're promoting them in their time, that's one thing. Or different types of artists. But you're in a slightly different realm, aren't you? You're not actually promoting work in its time or living artists, but you are promoting work that has an agenda or historical significance, right? I mean, isn't it a slightly
yes.
different twist than having than living artists' careers that you're building, essentially?
Yes. I mean, we, as I said, I think we, I mean, let's talk about maybe the most important artist that we have a substantial body of work by, which the artist is Hans Bellmer, and best known for having built two approximately life-sized adolescent female dolls to
right.
photograph in highly staged kind of surreal, erotic situations. And one of the dolls survives. It's in the Centre Pompidou in Paris. But the main way to see this and the intended way to see the work was photographically. And in fact, there are three books that compile photographs. Two kind of are the same. One is the first German edition from 1934, Die Puppe, and the French translation 2 years later, so 1936, La Poupée, and then in 1949, although intended to be realized earlier and the war and other factors intervening, Second World War, not realized until 1949, but called Le Jeu de la Poupée, The Games of the Doll. And but then, you know, there's also unique photographs, some in quite large format, some small ones. And this artist kind of was always important, had exhibitions throughout his lifetime, probably didn't sell a photograph at all. Probably until the 1960s, and maybe didn't sell any photographs. He also made drawings and a few paintings, and later a few sculptures also around the doll. And he didn't have any commercial success at all until the 60s. He died in 1975. I think around the age of 75. So it's only in the last 15 years of his life that he had any commercial success, and I would say it was modest at best, because in the late 50s he was living in a one-room apartment with his companion Unica Zern, who was another interesting character who's quite different in some ways, but the mold is, she had no commercial success during her lifetime as an artist, and is known primarily as a writer, in cult circles is kind of widely known as a writer, or as wide as cult circles can be, but who exhibited in the early 60s alongside Max Ernst and artists of that stature at a gallery called Le Pont Cardinal in Paris, but who really was completely unknown as an artist. Certainly in America, totally unknown, and even in France, I mean, virtually completely unknown. And around 2004 or 5, we managed to get works from the estate, her estate, and to make an exhibition that was subsequently followed by, and this kind of again, or not again, but it sort of is a good example of what I was saying about dealers and museums, two museum exhibitions, solo exhibitions, one at the Halle Saint-Pierre in Paris, which is principally a gallery of outsider art, and I'll come back to that in a second about Unica Zern. And also at the Drawing Center in New York, which is kind of a highly influential, small, not really museum, but more Kunsthalle, you know.
It's a wonderful place. Yeah.
So, both of those exhibitions had great success, and you know, we started with the prices extremely low to get work out there, and now things are, you know, I would say in general about 8 times more expensive than they were in 2005. So we fulfilled our dealer function in some way.
And also a historical function. I mean, that's what's really interesting to me is that you're educating a collector base and also an academic base about someone like this artist, and that's in part why their work is increasing in value. But it is because you're securing their historic position, isn't it? And your persuasive argument, which you must have of the importance of their historic position.
Yeah, well, I think that in the case of Una Concern, we diverted from Bellmare a bit, but we can come back there. But in the case of Una Concern,
sure.
As I said, you know, she, and let's talk about her just briefly because I think it is interesting.
Sure, I'd like to.
She was really well known, or really well is an exaggeration because in a narrow circle, she was really well known as a writer of these very dark, hallucinatory, autobiographic novels. Dark Spring, House of Illnesses, Man of Jasmine, which is a based on her relationship with another very interesting French artist intellectual named Henri Michaux, and who was a taker of drugs, in particular mescaline. It's not clear that she took any drugs. In fact, if I had to guess, I'm guessing not. She had enough issues psychologically. I don't think that she needed to confuse it with drugs. So she gets lumped in with outsiders in a certain sense because she's untrained as an artist. She only started making art after she met Bellmare in 1953 at his first exhibition in Germany after the war. He was German. He left Germany in 1938 after his first wife died. He was not Jewish, but he was vehemently anti-Nazi. And he left and went to France. And in 1953, he had his first exhibition in Berlin after the war at the Maison de France on the Kurfürstendamm. And at this opening, he met Una Concern, who looks in real life like his doll. I mean, it's eerie. And she moves to France with him right afterward, and they're together for the rest of her life because she jumped out of the window of their apartment in 1971. And she was, she starts making art after she meets Bellmare, and she's very interested in anagrams, and she makes anagrammatical art and art that actually incorporates anagrams text into her art. And for 10 years between 1961 and 71, she was in and out of Sainte-Anne, the main psychiatric hospital in Paris. But she's exhibiting alongside the likes of Max Ernst, and she's a participant in some of the major surrealist exhibitions, and she's in the circle of André Breton and well, again, Max Ernst, Marcel Duchamp, you know, Dali, I mean, and, you know, whoever Bellmare.
Just fascinating. I mean, I'm so glad we're discussing her and you're talking about her because I had no idea of the breadth of her work and contribution.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So I mean, whoever Bellmare, and maybe I misspoke when I said some of these names, but, you know, I doubt it because Bellmare knew all these people because, you know, he was part of, he never was a card-carrying member, meaning having signed the Surrealist Manifesto that Breton typically demanded of people who were around him. But somehow Bellemare, I think because he was always considered somewhat strange, he got a pass, and he did his own thing. But he was a participant in all the major Surrealist exhibitions, and he was there. You know, he was not even just, yeah, maybe it was tolerated, but I think with some people he was really friendly. And but Una Concern, you know, fails the test of an outsider because she wasn't an outsider. You know, she exhibits characteristics of an outsider, like psychoses and lack of formal training, which are typical characteristics of what we now call outsider art. But she was the ultimate insider in a certain sense, being friendly with, or certainly aware of, the art of these major 20th century figures. And then her art, you know, for 40 years, nothing happened, or, you know, certainly 30 years, more than 30 years, nothing happened. Nobody paid any attention to it, and it just sat there, and sat there in a kind of a familial situation where the daughter who inherited this, you know, was also, you know, kind of afflicted with mental illness, and really didn't know how to deal with it, and wasn't until you know, we were able to kind of pry this stuff loose with a promise to get it recognized properly. And so the Drawing Center exhibition had 49 works in it, and all of them came from us or through us, meaning from collectors that we had sold it to, or from the families of Thurn herself and Bellemare, her companion. So, you know, without us, that exhibition doesn't happen. We were the facilitators. But, you know, the Drawing Center, you know, they have much greater reach than, of course, we do. You know, we're a small gallery.
But they play very different roles, too. I mean, your role, which is fascinating the way you're talking about it and articulating her history, because it plays a very different role than a nonprofit center like the Drawing Center, which engages the public in a different way, but you have very common goals, whereas sometimes that may not be the case with contemporary gallery. The context of what you're talking about and the importance of the artist is so central to what you're doing.
Well, I don't think that the contemporary gallery that it's really that different, their idea. I just think that they might be out in front of themselves, if you know what I mean. Maybe there are people who can, I'll make a wine analogy. I don't know if it's apt, but, you know, I imagine that there's wine that you taste today that people can taste and say, oh, you know, in 20 years, this is going to be a great wine. That's not me. I can taste the wine 20 years later and say, oh, this is a great wine. But I don't have the ability to tell you today, in 20 years, this is going to be a great wine. And
Well, but also what you can do is you can find wine that people never had 20 years ago and explain to them why it is a great wine.
Oh, well, let's not get into that because
wine, I don't remember that is
wine is I love wine. And and when I go to buy wine, which I guess it's really not that different than my gallery, I always ask for what's the strange. I always say I'm a weird wine person. What's the strange, unusual, different bottle of wine that I can learn something from? And that's what I ask every sommelier when I look at a wine list, and they'll say, oh, well, can you give me an example of what you like? And I can. And I would reel off things that, again, I mean, people who are highly educated about wine certainly know, but the people who are less so may never even have heard of. And I'll get a plug in for it. I mean, one of the things that I've been into, not recently, but for the past, I would say, 6 years, is something that people call orange wine. And lots of people, even educated people, particularly outside, I think in the United States we have an awareness of it, and in kind of northeastern Italy into Slovenia, Croatia, they certainly do. But people say, oh, is that wine made from oranges? No, it's white wine, but you know, all wine gets its color from the grapes in the liquid, from the maceration. And white wine typically has no maceration. You don't put those skins in with the pressed juice. Red wine, you press the juice, it's clear, maybe with a pinkish cast, but it's clear. And then you put the skins in for however long, you know, months, year, whatever. And then when you remove them, the liquid is red. White wine, you can do the same thing. Leave the skins in for 15 days, maybe a year even. And when you remove it, it can be from light, more yellow than your typical white wine, to virtually a red-orange color. And it's really interesting. So if for your audience, if you haven't tried some orange wine, or you can call it macerated white wine, go and try some. It's really, you'll learn something. You may not like it, but you will learn something. And that's the way I feel about art, my art. I'm always looking for things that are kind of unusual, traditional. I mean, actually, probably maybe even the first white wine was made in this fashion. And it's only later that we don't put tannins and things in white wine. And now we're revisiting something, and that's the way I feel about the art. I'm trying to revisit something, learn something, have a visceral reaction that I don't... that's what I look for in art. I want to have a not only an intellectual reaction, I want to have a physical reaction. And so I'm always looking for really tough, weird, interesting stuff. But I have the benefit of looking in books and kind of looking, let's say, I look at the 1938 Surrealist exhibition, and I look at all the artists who were in there, and you know, lots of names you know, but even more you probably don't, or even the educated art consumer doesn't. And I look at those, you know, at those, because, well, one is I can actually get some of the stuff because the prices points aren't totally, I mean, now they're higher than they were, but they're not totally crazy. I mean, it's not like trying to buy a Cubist painting. I mean, you can't do that anymore.
Right.
Because the work, both from a price-wise and an availability, it's not doesn't have the same following, but you know, maybe there is an estate, or there is a pocket of work with somebody, you know, that you can find. You can actually track it down, and that's what we do. We find the relatives or the people who ended up who were the collectors of this material, and we bring it to light again, And Bellmer and Zern are not the only two that we really did it with Zern. With Bellmer, particularly in drawings, there's a broader market, and we're a major player, but we're not the only player. In photography, we really, because we have probably close to 150 vintage photographs printed around the time the negative was made. I mean, that dwarfs what anybody else has. So, so we are the kind of the market there.
Well, it's exciting. I share your view of new things. I'm excited to try some orange wine. I love that story. and also Hans and Uta, there'll be links for people to learn more in the interview about that. So I'm so glad you shared, especially her work with us. Adam, I want to thank you for talking with me tonight. I really appreciated your time here.
Okay.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.